Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the School of History podcast at the University of Leeds. My name is Dr. John Gallagher. I'm a lecturer in early modern history here at Leeds and the director of admissions. And today I'm really, really excited to be speaking with a new colleague of mine, Dr. Danveer Singh Brar, who is our new lecturer in Black British History. Danveer, brilliant to have you.
Thanks for inviting me, John. Glad to be here.
I'm really looking forward to the conversation. I was going to start, I always ask people to tell us a little bit about their journey as a researcher. So how did you wind up studying what you do today?
It depends where you start off telling a story and kind of constructing a narrative. I guess the easiest place would be that I just followed things that interest me and that I, you know, enjoyed talking about and thinking about. So, you know, as a school leaver and going into university, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I knew I was interested in reading about ideas and reading about art and culture. And it was only really in the third year of my degree I studied English and history combined, a joint honors program at University of Southampton. And then my final year, I was taught by a PhD candidate in a seminar, and who seemed kind of approachable. And I just literally asked, well, how do you end up doing what you do? And he just basically explained to me that, you know, how he got there, and that basically you could make a living out of this thing of reading and writing and thinking about what the stuff that, like, you have a geeky obsessive attachment to. So that became a path. I kind of had it vaguely in my head to try and do some sort of kind of journalistic writing or critical writing in the public sphere, but I, you know, being a son of migrants, the main thing, they're like, whatever you do, you've got to be able to earn a living out of it. And I could never really work out how anyone made a living out of journalism. And obviously, you know, it dawned on me much later that nowadays you've got to be the child of someone with access to funds to be able to support a career like that, which tells you a lot about the class dynamics of public intellectual culture in this country. But, you know, a path through a PhD and, eventually kind of floating around and getting the odd job here and there seemed a way, okay, I can do some work alongside studying and writing and collaborating with as many people as possible along the way. As I can, yeah. So it was just a kind of, I guess it was a way of avoiding doing a proper job.
I think sometimes that's the answer for a lot of us, a frightening number of us as well. But yeah. I mean, for you, that the interest that kind of led you through that process was, you know, an interest in music and in sonic culture and in those ideas of diaspora and migration as well.
Yeah.
What are kind of the, would they be kind of the main themes of the research that you do?
Yeah. I think pretty quickly I knew I had a sense in which I wanted to study something about the way in which expressive. I mean, now I'm retroactively kind of refitting this, but I knew it was something about the way in which music, literature and film worked and how it was made. That was definitely something that was in the back of my mind. It's why I studied English and the English portion. But the history part was my interest in the politics of race. Those things came together very quickly at Southampton. I had some very good teachers, Herman Rappaport, Stephen Morton, Cora Kaplan, who kind of really supported those interests and led me down some fascinating paths. Peter Middleton also. The main thing that kind of like a light bulb moment for me was when I'd been taking courses on film particularly because there wasn't much on sonic culture available in the degree, but there was kind of things in film that you could begin to talk about music. And one day I just kind of just took a record into one of the my teacher's offices and just said, look, how do I write about this? I've been writing about these interesting films and experimental films you've introduced me to by you know, the likes of the Black Audio Film Collective or Melvin Van Peebles or others or Agnes Varda. And I've been reading the likes of, you know, kind of Stuart Hall and others. But how do I write about this? And he's like, go and read this person. That person was Amiri Baraka. And I read Amiri Bracco, and it just kind of, then things just started kind of really flourishing at a quite rapid rate. And you know, it's not as if it was a success or it worked straight away. I wrote some like pretty terrible stuff that was trying to kind of imitate Bracco's style, but it was an important moment. I was like, okay, here's a way of doing it. And it seems to be speaking to the concerns that I'm interested in.
And I guess that was a way of getting into writing about sound and music and sonic culture.
Yeah.
I suppose then how would you know if a student came to you and asked that question of, you know, bring the record to class, how do I write about this? I mean, what have you learned in kind of writing about music and sonic culture in that time?
I think the main thing is read as many other people who write about music and sonic culture. That gives you a way in. Like, because I think the way writing about sound or writing about sonic culture is you're basically transcribing, you're trying as best as possible to transcribe and think about the listening experience. And so when you're reading other people writing about, like, particularly music critics and people, music critics who perhaps develop into longer form writers, they retain some kind of attachment to this kind of attempt to transcribe and then theorize the listening experience and then historicize it and politicize it or think about its politics. I think that's the best way. You listen as much as possible and you read as much as possible and you also write as much as possible. So notebooks, I keep notebooks, lots of them, and they kind of always filling up when I find them. Like, yeah, just useful. If I'm ever, I keep notes on stuff that kind of maybe sparks an idea or something that I'm listening to that interests me. And then maybe later on down the line, I recall that I wrote this thing and that can often become a basis for an article or something that I'm working on.
Fantastic. I mean, can we chat a bit, I think, then about your recent book?
Sure.
So this is Tech Life, Ghettoville, Esky, Sonic Ecologies of Black Music in the Early 21st Century. So, yep. And this is a book that takes us from London to Chicago, through a whole bunch of genres of music. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Yeah. The thing about books is that, again, you retrofit an idea onto something that you've kind of fallen upon. So I'd started from the prompting of friends, because my PhD research was in the relationship between sound and politics in basically the Black Power movements and the Black Power and Civil Rights movements of the US in the 60s. So I was kind of had a basis in historical research in with that regards. But I'd had, you know, all throughout that, basically since my teens, I've been committed to electronic music and electronic dance music. And I've been reading, writing about it avidly all through that time. And I just kind of, when I finished my PhD, I wanted to try something else. And through the prompting of friends and through some actually collective kind of projects and writing exercises and publications we did together, I started falling upon this, I guess, a way of writing about the contemporary. I tended to try and leave the contemporary alone during my PhD because I was so kind of trying to figure out the particular politics and the dynamics of that 60s, 70s moment. And it just kind of, it fit together really quickly in terms of not only a method of writing, but a set of concerns seemed to appear very quickly about the city and due to various... I guess kind of various political campaigns and community campaigns I was part of around policing and housing and so on, that the politics of the city and this change of dynamics of the city became a concern for me. And I realized that was being worked out through my interest in particular music forms that were concerned with urban space in the city in not always explicit ways. But that's, you once you started to study them and think about them, you're like, okay, yeah, this is about city space and the ability to live in contemporary city. So it really spun out from there. And then I realized I was writing, I'd written something about grime. I'd written something very loose about footwork. I could see a connection there. And then the kind of Actress album fell in my lap. And I'd always been an avid listener of actresses. So I go, okay, I've got these three long essays here. I'm going to just work on them. There was an attempt, I was thinking of expanding it even further, but I just thought, I've got three decent things to get my teeth into here. Once I gave it a framework, I thought, nah, that's enough. I didn't want to try and write a completist book. It was more of a kind of attempt to initiate a conversation or like extend a conversation that was already, as I try to show in the book, has already been taking place, but hasn't been given a great deal of attention or hasn't been kind of thought in a coherent sense. And that's really where it took off. Like the relationship between black electronic music, urban space, and the intellectual politics of thinking and writing about that music as well.
It seems like kind of that link between scenes and the kind of broader political context is so key to what you're doing. And yeah. one of the things that interests me in, you know, looking at your work is that you're, I guess, thinking about music as this place where kind of race and class intersect, and maybe is it a sense that you can tell new stories or take new perspectives on race and class, maybe on diaspora as well, by looking at music scenes?
Yeah. I think one of the things the book, it was kind of something that was already there and already evident in the music and to the musicians themselves and already evident to its immediate audiences. What I think the book allowed me to bring out is that the idea that working class black communities don't undertake kind of what we might regard in a categorical sense as avant-garde experimentation is a misnomer, right? It's experimentation on different terms, and I think that's what worked out very quickly for me. The idea that working class musical expression is defined by so-called directness or simplicity is a kind of doing a kind of level of discursive violence to people who occupy those particular social categories, and that's something that came out very quickly in the book, that there's some kind of what quite wild, fantastical, nuanced, detailed, rich levels of expressive experimentation that also then becomes social experimentation. The question of its transfer to the political realm is different. That's kind of always been, that's like the $64,000 question in a lot of the work about diasporic expressive culture, is the transfer point to politics. It seems it's there, it's definitely a transfer point, but how is it articulated? How does it work out? And, you know, as is the way with any kind of discussion of, let's say, popular culture in the 20th century, you can have a lot of political content in music, but then you always seem to, music which has an explicit political content sometimes seems to fall flat. And you've got that weird, why are some of the most cheesiest pop songs the most kind of attractive and appealing? What's going on there? There's a kind of strange sort of, it's not a mystery, but it's kind of a really fascinating conundrum. And I think that's kind of part of the debates that are going on in the book.
That's really, really cool. I mean, I want to ask, so as you know, I'm someone, I work in the 16th century.
Yeah.
And I kind of work in, I look at letters and diaries and a bit of that, in part because no one I'm studying is still alive, or if they are, they keep it a very low profile. But your research process is really exciting to me because, you know, you're not just looking at in kind of like traditional archives, you're also engaging with places and communities around the music, you're engaging with people who are still active in kind of creating creating music and art, you're engaging with record shops, everything like that. What does the research process and research materials look like for the kind of projects you're working on?
It depends on each one, but actually what I tend to do is begin with the material that's been produced by artists first and foremost. So if it's a record, if it's a film, I begin with that first and my immediate set of responses. And then I try to gradually build a sense of, gather together a sense of how this thing was assembled. What went into its making? How was it produced? I kind of tend not to always interview artists actually about it, and that might be a real mistake on my part, but one of the tendencies within writing and research about urban music cultures or music culture in general is the kind of the ethnographic against a kind of theoretical approach, it's not to say that either is there's a right or wrong approach, but there's a tendency to rely, I think in some sense, particularly with Black urban musical forms, to rely on ethnography as a kind of strict process that can limit a capacity to think about the, let's say, the meanings of the music. So I tend not to interview artists, partly because I'm not trained in that process. I mean, friends keep on pushing me that I should, and I probably will try to at some point in future projects. But I tend to actually prefer to work on the people, those who are very good at interviewing people. So journalists who do it for a living. And I tend to deploy kind of journalist articles or interviews in publications and magazines and so on. And I think they're interesting because the artist is actively trying to present an interpretation of their work to the world through an interview with a journalist. They know they're speaking to an audience. If they were speaking to me, I get the feeling, well, they're not necessarily access an audience. They're speaking to a researcher whose books might not get all that much, really. So I tend to use those materials to kind of build up a picture. And nowadays, it's not only printed materials. There's wider range of talks and interviews online, podcasts, all sorts with artists. It's not to say I don't talk to, let me rephrase that. I do talk to artists, but I talk to them a lot more informally. Put it that way, right? So in the smoking area outside a club or a venue, or maybe just through a kind of private chat, an informal chat, maybe just getting to know them a little bit. But I would never say, okay, I would like to sit down formally interview you about this thing I'm going to write about your work.
I mean, I think, it's so clear that that's the kind of conversation, as you say, where you'd need to approach it really, really carefully to make sure that, because people are going to kind of give coherence to a narrative that might not necessarily have it. Maybe they're going to do a bit of self-advertisement, the whole thing. So that's really, really interesting to think about the pitfalls of having kind of people you can talk to around this. Mm-hmm. Something we were talking about recently, which really grabbed me, was that you were talking about the place of record shops in your teaching. Also in your research more generally. I wondered if you could say a little bit about that.
I mean, it's not entirely, I mean, it's not new at all, but the idea of a record shop as a kind of a living memory vault, and which is easily accessible. You don't need to get a membership or email in to get access to it. You can touch the stuff, you can pick it up, you can handle it as much as you want. And usually you don't have to spend all that much to go home with a decent amount of materials. But it's the records, although, you know, music comes in multiple forms now. And I think it's important not to get romantic, I think, about record shops, but, you know, they're wonderful places to hang out in and spend time in. And they're often community hubs as well. But, you know, we've got to live in the realities of the world we're in, that the vast majority of music is consumed through online platforms. And, you know, not necessarily all of those are evil. Like something like Bandcamp is really productive because artists are getting a direct conversation with their audience. They get a far more bigger cut of the money from the sale. There's less intermediary. And you get a sense of you're dealing with a kind of more self-organized community of artists on something like Bandcamp. You know, obviously Spotify exists and it's got its huge problems with the way it treats artists. The record shop is important just to go and pick up things and handle them. Like to me, it's no different to a bookshop. And asking students to go to a bookshop isn't outlandish. No. So if you're teaching a module on music, it doesn't seem outlandish to me to say to them, you know, go down a record shop and try and spend like a fiver and see how much you get for a fiver and then bring it into a class and talk about it.
I think it's amazing that idea of kind of record shop as community hub, but also as a kind of archive as well. Is really, really exciting to me. I've done a lot of work on 16th century bookshops. So like the dream is that you could kind of wander in and see what you could find. I think doing that kind of work then would be incredibly interesting as well. Yeah. But that brings me on to, I wanted to ask you pretty much as a last question, really, just to ask you a little bit about your own teaching at Leeds. So one module of yours that I've been looking at enviously, I always do these interviews and I get really excited by other people's teaching and I want to go and take the class, is the one called Base Culture in Modern Britain. And I wondered if you could tell us a bit of it, because that's running this term, right?
Yeah, it's running at the moment, yeah.
So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's a really basic premise that base culture, the cultural form of manipulating, experimenting with sound as both an expressive and a social element, that comes out of the Caribbean, comes out of Jamaican sound system culture. The way that that has manifested in Britain and the way it has generated further mutations in kind of musical and social production. So the module follows just a kind of pretty basic historical narrative going from the 50s up until roughly the present moment, touching on various instances in the life of bass culture in Britain, the development of sound systems, roots reggae, dub, lovers rock, rare groove. What else is there? There's Asian based culture, jungle, garage, and grime. I think grime is the final one. I decided not to have something on drill, but I might bring something in on drill in later weeks. So yes, it's a basic kind of premise, but yeah, the idea is more method based. Trying to say to students, well, no, there is a way of thinking about historical consciousness through sound, and that actually bass culture is the kind of living repository of black working class consciousness in Britain, there are key people who have operated as interpreters of it. You know, Linton Kwesi Johnson, who coins the term bass culture, Paul Gilroy, Lloyd Bradley, and obviously the musicians and artists themselves are key interpreters of the music. And that basically there's this kind of way of thinking about black working class history in Britain through the music, that it's there. And its rate of innovation and its rate of change shows that it's probably the cutting edge of working class expressive and social culture, and perhaps arguably political culture. And therefore it hasn't really, apart from the key figures I mentioned there, like Johnson and Gilroy and others, that it hasn't really been thought through in a systematic sense. It's not to say I'm doing it. I just thought, well, here's a module that students might find interesting as a way to gather their ideas. You know, maybe years down the line, someone comes through the module who decides to take that up as a potential MA or PhD research project. And, you know, I'll be glad if that's happened to someone along the way.
Yeah, I think that's the hope. It's always brilliant to see. I suppose that just does bring me on to an actual last question. Sorry, I know I promised the last one be, but that's because you've kind of tied that to that broader field of Black British history, which is obviously so important in so many conversations at the moment. I think for us at Leeds, it's an area where we've been developing new teaching, but it's also where these, as you say, kind of really exciting ongoing conversations and new research. Would you say, as a lecturer in Black British history, do you have kind of hopes for where, as a kind of as a conversation or set of conversations, it's going to go next?
I mean, there's lots of exciting. I mean, I think the first thing to say is I'm not a trained historian, as is traditionally recognized. I guess I'm more of a cultural studies scholar with a historical orientation. So I would be, although my job is as a lecturer in Black British history, I would never, I have too much respect for trained historians to claim that title. But I have read and engaged with a lot of the exciting work taking place across the field of Black British history at the moment, in several institutions. But I'd say firstly, that it shouldn't just be me doing it at this institution. We should hire plenty more people to broaden the field. But the particular area which I think I can start to I can help contribute to the conversation is through expressive culture. Expressive culture, intellectual politics. A kind of like the venue where I think I can offer students a chance to kind of develop ideas and develop kind of ways of thinking. I would obviously be happy to have conversations with people who work in the broad range of Black British history, but I would never deign to kind of, you know, have a handle on the particular questions that they're dealing with. So I think, yeah, actually, you know, I'm delighted to be here. I'm happy to be here, but you know, let's use it as an opening to get in more people who can kind of broaden and enrich the ideas and debate.
Well, I think that would be absolutely superb. David, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today. It's been brilliant to hear about the teaching and the research.
No problem. Thanks, John. Take care.
Thanks again.